The headlines: crowds of people attend a funeral procession for the victims of a recent terrorist attack in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz. Iran says U.S. sanctions are blocking the import of food and medicine in the breach of a ruling by the International Court of Justice. Also ahead, Russia warns against the U.S. deployment of modernized nuclear weapons across Europe. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gitumish Ahmadi, and these are our top stories of this hour. A funeral procession has taken place in the southern Iranian city of Shiraz for the victims of a recent terror attack on a holy shrine there. Thousands of mourners turned out for the funeral service. They chanted slogans condemning terrorism and those behind the heinous crime. At least 13 people were confirmed dead in the Wednesday terrorist attack, among them women and children. Over 24 were also wounded. A gunman started shooting from one of the entrances of the shrine. He then headed to the main compound, firing at pilgrims and staff. The assailant was finally injured by security forces and later succumbed to his wounds in the hospital. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the United States and Israel have hatched a sinister plot to incite the recent riots across the country. Major General Hossein Salami was speaking at a funeral procession of the victims of the Wednesday terror attack in Shiraz. He said the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia are desperate about their back-to-back defeats in West Asia, including in Yemen. Salami said those behind Iran's riots cannot tolerate the Islamic Republic's political and spiritual influence across the region. Therefore, he added that they have resorted to provoking unrest inside Iran, but to no avail. The military official also said that Washington has a long history of making attempts to weaken Iran, referring to U.S. sanctions as a case in point. Salami added that Iran has successfully overcome hurdles caused by those sanctions. Researcher and activist Hossein Chekhian says the recent wave of unrest and rioting in Iran opened a window of opportunity for those behind the Shiraz terror attack.
The terrorist attacks take place if the security of the society is harming, if the security forces are busy doing something else, some people like ISIS members could have the opportunity to attack some shrines or some places around the cities of Iran. So we have to confront it. I think in the media, in this past 40 days, we have been such a harmful atmosphere for Iran's picture and image in whole world, because all the CIA medias, I mean all the Mossad medias, all the Saudis medias, are together planned a war, a really soft, a really hard soft war, should we say, against the people of Iran. And it brings up such an attack.
Masoud Shajari is the chairman of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission. He says the United States and Israel and Saudi Arabia are behind the recent riots in Iran.
The reality is that the Saudis and the Israelis and the Americans for a very long time saying that they're going to bring their fight into Iran and create sort of disharmony and indeed instability. This is something that if anyone studies the speeches and the statement from these entities, will be in no doubt that that has been the plan. The fact of the matter is that this is the sort of opportunities that they use. They try to sort of back the sort of a concern of innocent people coming out and sort of demonstrating legitimately according to the legal status and indeed according to the constitution of Iran. But they back that, they back up, they sort of back ride this innocent concern of the citizens of Iran, and they turn it into riots, they turn it into instability, they turn it into creating sort of instability from a security point of view.
Iran says U.S. sanctions have prevented its imports of food and medicine. Iran says this is against a ruling by the International Court of Justice mandating what Washington exempts as food and medicine from the bans. Iran's deputy U.N. ambassador Zahra Ershadi says the U.S. has failed to comply with the court order. She says the U.S. has even imposed additional sanctions on Iran, openly defying the judgment. Ershadi made the statement while speaking during a UNGA debate on the International Court of Justice. The U.S. has launched a campaign of maximum pressure on Iran since former President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal. Under the policy, Washington reimposed unilateral sanctions that were removed under the accord. Political commentator Scott Bennett earlier shared his thoughts on the issue. Let's take a listen.
It is a crime against humanity. It's a crime of genocide. It's a weapon of genocide. Of course, this shouldn't surprise us, first of all, from the political leadership of a country that has killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children under Madeleine Albright, that has killed children in, of course, the Iraq-Iran war with the chemical weapons that the United States supplied to Iraq. And now we see the United States also killing the children and elderly senior citizen people in Ukraine by empowering the fanatical maniacs of the woke left in the Nazi tattooed uniform of Zelensky's regime to bomb and engage in genocide. So it shouldn't surprise us that there's no moral restraint or sanity or decency in the Western hegemonic obsessionists in the political and military class. This should, of course, be brought up to the entire world community and the entire United Nations and the entire world criminal court, and it should be demanded that sanctions against the United States are imposed for this crime of genocide, this crime against humanity.
Iran's foreign minister once again dismisses allegations that it has provided drones to Russia to use in the war in Ukraine. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran's policy regarding the war in Ukraine is refraining from sending weapons to the warring parties. He made the comments in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart. The foreign minister also said Tehran respects the territorial integrity of countries and seeks to stop the war and the displacement of people. He called for Ukrainian officials to avoid the influence of some extremist European politicians. Amir Abdullahian also expressed Iran's readiness to hold technical meetings with Ukrainian military experts on the issue of drones. For his part, Dmytro Kubela welcomed Iran's stance and highlighted the importance of technical military talks between the two countries. Russia's defense minister says partial mobilization of 300,000 reservists to fight in Ukraine is now complete. Sergei Shoigu says that over a quarter of the draftees have been deployed in the battlefield. He also stressed that no additional mobilization is planned for now. This is the first mobilization of reservists in Russia since World War II. The Russian president ordered the call-up in September after he approved the annexation of four eastern Ukrainian regions. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has expressed doubt that the call-up is finished. He says Moscow may need to send new soldiers to the conflict zone very soon. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent Johnny Miller from Crimea with the latest developments.
Well, last night I was woken up by a series of loud explosions here in Sevastopol. Local authorities say that was the Russian Black Sea Fleet, based, of course, here in Crimea, shooting down Ukrainian drones. It's another indication of how much superior Russian air defense system systems are than their Ukrainian than Ukrainians. Ukrainians, of course, asking, pleading with the West or NATO to give them the most advanced weaponry to help them gain parity on the battlefield with Russia. But the United States particularly is wary at times to give Ukraine their most advanced weapons, worried that some of them might fall into Russian hands, that technology. Also perhaps worried that some of this technology may not be as good as they would hope. Would, for example, the most advanced NATO air defense system be able to shoot down the most advanced Russian missiles? So in terms of, also in terms of this mobilization, Russia, of course, says they've completed the mobilization of 300,000 soldiers. They say about 80,000 of those are already in the battle zone.
Russia is warning against the U.S. plan to bring forward the deployment of upgraded nuclear weapons to Europe. Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushenko said the Kremlin cannot disregard the plan. He added that the accelerated deployment would lower, quote, the nuclear threshold. U.S. media have reported that Washington would speed up its plan to store modernized versions of tactical nuclear weapons at NATO bases in Europe. The reports say that the arms would be delivered in December, several months earlier than planned. The U.S. has around 200 such weapons, with half of those kept at bases in Europe. Russia's warnings come at a time of tensions over the war in Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned Western states against supplying weapons to Ukraine. Russia is also strongly opposed to NATO's expansion eastward. Meanwhile, 10,000 jobs are at risk in southern Italy as a refinery will be soon hit by an embargo of Russian oil, which kicks in a few weeks. Meanwhile, the Italian government is working on ways to keep the plant owned by a Russian corporation called Lukoil in business. Max Civelli reports.
Earlier this month, Brussels approved the eighth round of sanctions on Russia over the conflict in Ukraine in an attempt to deprive Moscow of billions of euros in revenues from selling products in the European Union. In a previous round of sanctions, the sixth, Brussels had approved an embargo on Russian seaborne oil that will come into force on December the 5th. This punitive measure will severely affect the Isab refinery, located on Sicily Island in the south of Italy. The refinery, owned by the Russian multinational energy corporation Lukoil, used to buy about 40% of its feedstock from Moscow. Due to the embargo, the plant could shut down in a few weeks, leaving thousands of people jobless.
These workers have been on permanent employment contracts for many years. They are very worried about what lies ahead. A closure of the refinery would reverberate on the region's satellite activities, affecting about 10,000 workers. We have received assurances from the new government that a positive solution will be found.
Although Lukoil was not singled out by EU sanctions, the Isab plant, which accounts for around 20% of Italian refining capacity, has been forced to rely solely on Russian oil since international banks are no longer providing the refinery with credit to buy oil from alternative suppliers.
Per quanto riguarda queste sanzioni sul petrolio,
EU financial sanctions usually contain derogation provisions which allow competent authorities to authorize activities that would otherwise be prohibited. These provisions should be immediately applied to the Isab refinery case. This embargo on Russian oil will only have the consequence of further damaging the EU's energy market.
A last shipment of Russian oil is expected to reach the Isab refinery by December the 5th. The Italian government has a bit over a month to find a solution to the issue. There seems to be two ways only to avert the closure of the Isab plant. Either the refinery gets nationalized and the Italian government is reportedly mulling over this option, or it is sold to non-Russian buyers. Some media have reported that U.S. private equity fund Crossbridge is among parties interested in buying the refinery. Actually, there is also a third option that could work for Isab: continue the same way as today. But that would imply a normalization of ties between the EU and Russia, an option that seems non-viable at this stage. Max Civelli, Rome.
The United States has officially ended its economic recession, but a double dip recession is expected to be around the corner. That has the 63% of Americans who live paycheck to paycheck especially concerned as they head to the ballot box next week. Ramin Mazahiri reports.
New data shows that the United States economy ended its recession last quarter, but there is widespread admission across the mainstream media that the official numbers don't capture the depth of economic difficulties. At 2.6% in the third quarter, it was the first sign of GDP growth in 2022. However, if the vast increase in the sales of arms and gas to Europe are excluded, then the U.S. economy would have shrunk 0.2%, thus remaining in recession. So what's truly keeping the U.S. economy afloat is the lack of a diplomatic solution to the unrest in Ukraine.
It's terrible for the economy. You know, on paper, it shows that a certain factor of the economy is doing well during war because they're the ones making money off of the weapons. But for real people, it's only bad. And we call for an end to all unjust wars.
Many point to non-governmental data for the true state of the economy. A new survey shows that a stunning 63% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. With inflation at levels unseen in nearly four decades, credit debt at levels unseen in three decades, and unemployment expected to soar this winter, most economists are predicting a return to recession known as a double-dip recession.
It's a bipartisan problem of two parties that don't support anyone but themselves and their own corporate fundraisers. Inflation is said to be the most insidious of all taxes. It confiscates our wealth, a good part of it in a way that no one even realized.
The lack of broad economic stability is the primary reason that the Democratic Party is polling to lose control of Congress in the midterm elections on November 8th. That would create a divided government, which would make implementing economic solutions at the federal level even harder. This looming political stagnation is fueling even more pessimism about the future, which may then create even more Americans who are just one paycheck from disaster. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
temperature.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans, a military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions there. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917 when mustard gas is used for the first time and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, over 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. Find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. we decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible. And we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded, and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage, because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that C is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents. Whereas the mustard gas decomposes to thiodiglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater, to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances. Whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases, and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases both in Denmark but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you know them there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and Lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard. The military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia. Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm.
And we have manual, so we can how to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here. You have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area. And a red area for extra precaution.
Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of For a Better Life. This is Asma, and as usual, we're going to go through some ideas that might help us improve our life. Actually, I'm not a preacher and I did not have the intention to lecture you as a preacher. It's a heart-to-heart whisper and we'll have some time to think about things that matter the most in our life as human beings. So there are delicate things in life that we don't come to notice until it's too late. There's this famous poem that says, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players." You must have heard it. It actually is a poem by William Shakespeare. And then it says, "They have their exits and their entrance." Well, right in this very line, the whole story of life lies. Now, in literature, the theme of life being a short journey keeps reappearing, and it definitely catches too much of attention from the audience. As for every single one of us, we do think of a day that we no longer have any more of time to do anything. It's an inevitable truth that no one lives forever, and there'd be a day that we'll die after all. Now, don't call me a bitter-tongued speaker for saying this, but really, how often do we think of this fact? How does it affect our life? Is it a depressing thing to keep death in mind? What's the point of remembering death every now and then? Well, before we go for the answers, let's go for a tiny little break and then we'll follow today's topic.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome back. Thank you for sticking around. This is For a Better Life, and we are talking about the short journey of life and the fact that death is very close, and in any time, I might be gone forever, and that is so sad, and I start my eternal life, which is the good news, of course. Well, every time we hear of someone's death, a moment of manifestation happens to us. It's as if the clock of our soul stops for a second and we can see the true face of life. At that very moment, I remember that all the hustles and bustles of life are trivial and all the beauties of life are mere distractions. If I have not been aware of the essence of my life, if I have not been close to my Lord, to the one who'll stay on my side forever. I remember there was a story which was called The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe, and it was a nice story. I recommend you to go for that, because through this story, you will see different phases of life. Actually, it's metaphorical and it's got too much of ideas in that. But the most fascinating part of that was the fact that whenever a death comes in the middle, whenever they heard of a death of someone, the clock that was sit there in the middle of the crowd started making a sound so that everyone would notice that something has happened, something which is very important. That's exactly what happens in our ordinary life. Whenever we hear about death that happens around us, we feel like it's keeping us. For a moment, we feel like, oh my God, what's happening? A moment of manifestation, just as I told you. Now, thinking of death might sound so dark and depressing, but once I heard it from a scholar who looked at it from a beautiful angle, which actually came from the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, he said, if we look at this transitory life as a short death, and in the opposite, look at death as the beginning of our life, then death is going to sound as freedom. Just like you're going to get rid of whatever that is so difficult, whatever that you've been through as a drudgery, you're going to say bye to all of that and then start a new life. Just like how Imam Ali alayhi salam puts it and says, death to a real believer and obedient of Allah is like taking out a worn out dress and wearing a new one. So just imagine how would that look like. It would be just as freedom, something new, something so cool. So I guess they must change the inscription on the tombstone and change the date of death with the date of birth. I mean, they have to write it as the date of birth instead of death itself. Because that's the true thing that happens. And maybe if we looked at it like this ever since we were a kid, then we wouldn't have this dark idea of death. So I guess they must focus on this very point. Everyone who's writing the tombstones, actually, I guess they have to change it all. Because then it would be more of a happy thing, not something mournful. Now, the first step is settled. Death might sound so gloomy, but if we look carefully, it's freedom. And it's to get rid of the sadness and difficulties of life. All the drudgeries, you're going to put them back. And there'd be no more of the sadness, no more of the terrible things that you feel every single night you put your head on the pillow.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The next point is about what's the use of remembering death so frequently? Well, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, constant remembrance of death will help us from getting too much immersed in the traps of life. And of course, it'll have us make the best of our chances. And, you know, you're going to be more focused on the things you want. If I think of no end for myself, then I'll stop trying and I'll perhaps stop seizing the opportunities for improvement. Maybe, I'll be selfish and greedy, and perhaps I'll see no goodness in helping others. Our holy book always reminds us of the temporary nature of life, and it keeps reminding us to seize the chances of salvation and never give in to this materialistic, mundane life. Another important fact about thinking of death is that by keeping this thought in our mind, we actually are saving ourselves from the possibility of feeling regretful for the things we should have done and yet we didn't. Now we got it settled. There's no more fear of death, and actually it's going to be a new start. And the goodness of keeping this thought in our mind is that it's going to help us have more of motivation, is going to help us think of every single day as a new chance that is not going to come back to us. And who knows, maybe the next second I will no longer be among the people who are the settlers of the earth. I might be gone. And so this is very much sad if we do not take the opportunity and if we do not actually do the things that are going to be our only achievements that will help us in the world to come. Because all these good deeds that we're going to do in this world, the mere use of them is to come to our rescue in a time to come in the other life. So that's all. Life is very much of a chance, and then death is a new birth through which you're going to make use of all the chances you've used in your life, of all the chances you've seized in your life and made the best out of them. So thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's session. Until another program, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. And every word I share, He knows. Allah knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.